Welcome once again to NPR's Movie Podcast, the best of this week's love to all things cinema. This week we're going to answer three questions. We've heard of Robert Downey Jr., but who was Robert Downey Sr.? Why did Spike Lee make a movie about World War II? And why was Robert Wagner so cool? You know, way before Austin What's-His-Name. But first, an appreciation of one of our favorite Hollywood heroes, Paul Newman.
Paul Newman. The cool con man in The Sting, the charismatic inmate in Cool Hand Luke, the swaggering cowboy in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. He died last night at his home in Westport, Connecticut. He was 83. Newman's interests went way beyond Hollywood, to the theater, car racing, a line of food products. He donated every penny of profit from the Newman's Own line to charity. NPR's Bob Mondello offers this appreciation.
He was handsome, smart, sensitive, and a fine actor, but for a lot of people, it really came down to those eyes. Cobalt blue, piercing, intelligent, and most of all, readable by the camera. Paul Newman could be still where other movie actors had to indicate their feelings, because if you looked into his eyes, you knew what he was thinking. They clouded when he was troubled, flashed with intensity when he got angry, and twinkled when he smiled, except when the smile was snarky, as it was when he played amoral Hud Bannon in the film Hud. Then those eyes turned steely.
Well, I always say the law was meant to be interpreted in a lenient manner. And that's what I try to do. Sometimes I lean to one side of it, sometimes I lean to the other.
Newman often told interviewers he originally took up acting not because he was driven by a passion for it, but to escape his father's sporting goods business. He claimed to have been one of the worst college actors ever, learning his lines by rote, not giving a thought to context or how they fit into the play. But after serving in the Navy during World War II, he studied at the Actors Studio in New York, got work in live television, and finally landed a role on Broadway in the drama Picnic. He played an ineffectual college kid in a small Kansas town otherwise populated by sex-starved women. Hollywood came knocking soon after, unfortunately with a role he quickly regretted taking, that of a Greek sculptor making a cup for Christ in the overblown religious drama The Silver Chalice. He found it so embarrassing he took out an ad in Variety apologizing for his performance, and years later, when he showed it to friends as a practical joke, he first handed out whistles and pots for them to bang on. But when he went back to Broadway, he quickly redeemed himself, playing a psychotic killer in The Desperate Hours and a conflicted alcoholic in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, a role he would repeat on screen opposite Elizabeth Taylor.
I feel all the time like a cat on a hot tin roof.
Then jump off the roof, Maggie, jump off it. Our cats jump off roofs and they land uninjured. Do it, jump.
Jump where? Into what?
Take a lover.
Playing Brick in Cat and other troubled characters in 50s TV dramas, Newman stopped being just another handsome lug and found the type of character that proved his strong suit. Not so much the conventional leading man his looks led you to expect, but an anti-hero whose flaws are what make him compelling. He perfected the type in what he called his Lucky H pictures, playing the pool shark in The Hustler, that amoral cowboy in Hud, the cynical private eye in Harper, and the stoic outcast in Hombre, all of which was just a prelude to the bad boy with a soul he played in Cool Hand Luke, who never met an authority figure he wouldn't talk back to, from prison warden to God himself.
It's beginning to look like you got things fixed so I can't never win out. Inside, outside, all them rules and regulations and bosses. You made me like I am. I just, where am I supposed to fit in? Oh, man, I gotta tell you, I started out pretty strong and fast, but it's beginning to get to me.
Something else was getting to Newman at about that time. Suitable roles seemed to be drying up, both for him and for his wife Joanne Woodward. So he stepped behind the camera as director and producer and solved both their problems. Rachel Rachel, in which Woodward played a lonely spinster awakening to life, earned her an Oscar nomination as Best Actress and won Newman plaudits for the almost invisible, actor-friendly direction that he later referred to as a sort of eavesdropping. He would direct his wife several other times and co-star with her too, but better roles and another partnership surfaced in the wake of Rachel Rachel. The partnership with Robert Redford as con men in The Sting and as outlaws on the run in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
I'll jump first.
Nope.
Then you jump first.
No, I said.
What's the matter with you?
I can't swim!
Why, are you crazy? The fall will probably kill you.
There were some later roles he probably shouldn't have taken. In Towering Inferno, for instance, no one really blazed with glory. But he was never not good in lesser films, and when well cast, as, say, the honest businessman victimized by an irresponsible prosecutor and careless journalist in Absence of Malice, he kept proving that he could rivet audiences by just staring them down. That was never more true than when he played the alcoholic, washed-up lawyer in The Verdict, who just won't stop.
You know, so much of the time we're just lost. Say, please, God, tell us what is right. Tell us what is true. I mean, there is no justice. The rich win, the poor are powerless. We become tired of hearing people lie.
If that sentiment sounds heartfelt, let it be said that Newman was himself devoted to social justice. Having been extremely fortunate in life, he considered it his obligation to help the less fortunate. His Newman's Own brand of food products, started as a joke in his basement, made him a big-time philanthropist, even as it allowed him to work the other side of the movie theater, providing not just the motion pictures, but the popcorn, too. He was such a big supporter of liberal causes that he made it onto President Nixon's enemy list. He called that the single biggest honor he'd ever received. He got others, of course, including 10 Oscar nominations, but he noted that once you've seen your face on a bottle of salad dressing, it's hard to take yourself too seriously. Newman announced last year that he was retiring from acting, something he'd also announced in 1995, only to come back to make 4 more movies, star on Broadway, and get nominated for an Oscar, a Tony, and an Emmy Award. So a lot of us kept fingers crossed that he'd be back again. The announcement today that Paul Newman has been taken by cancer means he won't, except, of course, on film and in the memories of anyone who's ever seen him peering out into the theater's darkness with those piercing baby blues. I'm Bob Mondello.
Robert Downey Jr. has been a busy actor recently. He's in 4 movies this year. But many people might not realize his father is also in the movie business. Robert Downey Sr. was a leading light in New York's underground film scene of the 1960s. Now, several of his early films have been restored with the help of a foundation headed by fellow director Martin Scorsese. Rick Carr has our story.
Robert Downey Sr. is probably best known for his 1969 satire Putney Swope.
It started last weekend at the L. Howard Gate.
It sent up both Madison Avenue and American race relations.
You gave me a soul kiss. Boy, it sure was grand.
When Downey made that, he was working at an ad agency, and he'd been shooting no-budget films on the streets of New York for nearly a decade. Critics and scholars say these movies are very important, and their restoration is big news. They were American cinema's answer to the French New Wave of Godard and Truffaut, groundbreaking experiments, right?
No. We were just out having fun doing this because we could. Here we were, writers and cameramen and stuff, saying, hey, you know, you got a script, I got a camera, let's go do something. That's all it was.
And that sense of, hey, kids, let's put on a movie, comes through in the films recently restored by New York's Anthology Film Archives. Take Downey's biggest early underground hit, for example, an absurd comedy from 1966 called Chafed Elbows. Its main character, Walter, wanders around New York City from one surreal encounter to another, cultivating his own nervous breakdown. At one point, an artist with a brush walks up to Walter on the street and paints something on his coat.
What's going on? I sign my initials on you. I call you man on street, outside warehouse. As soon as you dry off, report to the Washington Square Gallery.
The initials the artist paints are AW. When I ask Downey whether that stands for Andy Warhol, he rolls his eyes, like the answer's obvious. Back then, Downey says, everybody in New York seemed to know everyone else. Downey even worked with the young Woody Allen. And those interactions helped everyone's work.
It was a small world where everything collided. And people would help each other. You know, like, you need a camera, just get it back to me by Monday. Or if editing room, you can use it Friday night, Saturday, Sunday, but don't be here Monday when we walk in and leave me $100, that kind of thing.
The spirit of the random encounter is also at the center of another one of the restored films, another comedy of sorts from 1968 called No More Excuses. It cuts back and forth between four storylines, one about the assassination of President James Garfield, another made up of documentary footage from New York's 60s singles scene, a third featuring a Civil War soldier lost in 60s New York, and the fourth featuring a very earnest moralizer.
My name is Alan Abel, and I am Vice President of CINNA, the Society for Indecency to Naked Animals. Our organization is dedicated to the proposition that all animals should wear clothing for the sake of decency.
It's impossible to explain how it is that all of this nonsense just works. Downey and his collaborators manage to wring pathos and humor and even social comment that seems relevant today from the disparate stories. Anthology Film Archive's Andrew Lampert, who oversaw the restoration, says No More Excuses hadn't been shown for 40 years, which is a pity, he says, because it's truly a groundbreaking film. Even though Downey doesn't take the movie all that seriously, Lampert thinks it's as important as D.W. Griffith's masterpiece, Intolerance.
There are two films that both have multiple storylines, and rather than being sort of smoothly interlaced, they just both hit the wall a million times over and just keep going. No More Excuses is as raucous a movie as you could imagine. I mean, you just keep waiting for the guy in the gorilla suit to come out, but actually it's a real gorilla, you know?
Lampert says Martin Scorsese's Film Foundation jumped at the chance to fund Anthology's restoration of No More Excuses, Chafed Elbows, and another lost Downey film, Babbo 73, which centers on a future doltish president of the U.S., For his part, Downey says he's happy that his work has younger fans, especially those who were born after he made these films. He says their enthusiasm for his early work has inspired him, at age 71, to go to work on a new film.
They've made me think about the time I have left on this planet that I want to go back to that spirit of trying things and having fun and thinking about, you know, let's do something a little different. Then Act 1, Act 2, Act 3. Ugh, what a bore that is.
Downey won't say what his new film will be about. Until he finishes it, fans nationwide can urge their local art cinemas and screening rooms, those lucky enough to still have one, to get in touch with New York's Anthology Film Archives for one of the restored early movies. For NPR News, I'm Rick Carr.
And at our website, you can watch Robert Downey Jr. in a brief appearance in his father's 1975 film, Moment to Moment. That's at NPR.org.
Filmmaker Spike Lee's latest movie, Miracle at St. Anna, opened over the weekend. It took in a modest $3.5 million. It's a story about four members of the all-black 92nd Buffalo Soldier Division. They're fighting the Nazis, and they get trapped behind enemy lines in Italy during World War II.
You, come here.
Gather the rest, whoever will come, and we'll take them down the mountain.
We do not come with you.
Why not?
Nazis in all villages.
Yeah. Boom, boom. You just sit tight, and it'll be jingle bells real soon. The U.S. Army is sitting right here in front of you.
We need army inside house now. 3 years we've been waiting. First the British, then the Americans. Italy is tired to wait.
On Friday, we featured some of the stars of the film, plus its writer. Now we have NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates, who got the chance to sit down with Spike Lee. This has been a project of the heart for him. His mission started with the men of the 92nd Buffalo Soldier Division.
15,000 African-American men stationed in Italy. They fought in the army that was segregated. Many of their commanding officers were from the South. That was a policy of the army. They felt that somehow that white Southerners could control Negroes better than the white officers from the North. That was a recipe for disaster. That did not work out at all.
At one point in the film, one of the generals.
General Allman, uh-huh. real person.
Says this is Mrs. Roosevelt's little experiment, and we're going to have to live with it, which right. indicated to me that there was a fair amount of resentment at having to even deal with the idea of black combatants.
Yes, it's a known fact that it was the first lady, Eleanor Roosevelt, getting on her husband's case day after day, FDR. So he finally, probably to get some peace of mind, said, okay, I'll let them fight. Because they weren't allowed to fight at first. It was just, you could cook, you could clean, you could do the menial stuff, but they did not feel they had really the guts to fight that. When the bullets started flying, the black soldiers would just drop and run.
Were they also worried about black soldiers with guns?
Well, that was the case really in the States. Many towns had objections to these black bases with these men armed.
Yet you have these men who get separated from their general unit in the hills of Tuscany.
Right. Behind Nazi lines.
Behind enemy lines. They show up as I was looking at the film, I kept saying, you know, in some ways, this is the Italian equivalent of Appalachia. You know, they're living up in these tiny, isolated little hamlets where everybody knows everybody else, or they're related to everybody else in some kind of tangential way. They've got, you know, feuds and connections that go back several generations. And they've mostly seen their own people all this time.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, here come these brothers.
They've never seen a black person before, ever. But they saw these men as their liberators. They've been waiting for the United States Army. First, they were waiting for the British, and the Americans came. So this is true. While we were shooting Tuscany, several times elderly Italians told me about their fond memories as children seeing the Buffalo Soldiers, the black soldiers.
What did they remember about them?
Well, one lady told me that she's alive today because of Buffalo Soldiers. She had just been born a month or two old. She was dying of some illness. Her mother took her to the black camp. The black doctors gave her shots, probably penicillin, and she lived. And she told me the story, tears running in her eyes, and she just grabbed me and hugged me. She said, I'm alive because of the Buffalo Soldiers.
So they had more than one job while they were there. And it seems that they were acutely conscious of that they weren't just soldiers, that they had this larger responsibility that white soldiers, to a certain degree, didn't have.
And also many of them felt, as one of Derek Luke's characters says in the film, that for the first time they felt free. And they, in reflection, saying that it's a shame for the first time to feel free in a foreign country and not in their own home, their native land.
At one point, they were having an argument about whether they should stay, whether they should go, whether this was, you know, going to lead to certain disaster. And Staff Sergeant Aubrey Stamps says, I'm not doing this for me. I'm doing this for my kids, for my kids' kids. Mm-hmm. This is our country, too.
Progress.
This is progress. This is progress. We have to make progress. What did he mean by that?
Well, it's something that all African Americans have felt. I think it was felt when Crispus Attucks was killed by the British in the Boston Massacre. He was the first person to die in the war for the United States of America, a black man. We felt that in the Civil War, World War I, World War II, even today in Iraq and Afghanistan. I find it amusing when people question the patriotism of African Americans. It's so easy to be a patriot when you're receiving the full rights and benefits of a citizen. It's much more to be a patriot when you're being lynched, to live in apartheid or Jim Crow segregation, denied your rights as a human being. And despite that, again and again and again, African Americans have taken up the mantle and fought and died for this country. And as you said before, Stamps talk about promise. Well, we're about to see that promise finally. November 4th, this country's going to vote for the 44th President of the United States of America. The promise that Stamps talked about, I think we're getting to that point because this thing is going to happen. And that is, for me, concrete evidence that this country has made a seismic move as far as race relations go that we've yet to see. That a black man, someone whose father was born in Kenya, is going to be the commander-in-chief.
He certainly will be if he's elected?
He's going to win.
Okay. If he wins, does
I'm
fact...
Wait, whoa. You could say if.
Well, I have to. I'm a reporter.
Okay, but I'm not a reporter, and I can't let people ask me, so what happens if he... I don't think like that. The man... We're going to be delivered on November 4th. That's okay. Me. I'm speaking for myself.
Let's look at it from your perspective then. He gets elected on November 4th. Is part of why he gets elected this service that the real-life Aubrey Stamps have done, this down payment that they've made in order to get to this point?
It's not just him. We could go on. Harry Tubman, Sojourner Truth. Shirley Chisholm, W.D. Du Bois, Booker T. Washington, Malcolm, Dr. King, JFK, you know. So everything that's happened, you know, he's been able to, he's on their shoulders, I feel.
This is, in a way, this film, a big public thank you to people who didn't get thanked enough.
We filmed the supplement for the DVD recently of Miracle St. Anna. We had a round table with several Buffalo soldiers. These men now in their later ages. Very graceful, dignified men. And one gentleman, I can't recall his name, he said, I put my life in line for this country. And I was hoping and praying that this would hopefully prove to white America that we were worthy and we belong and we're Americans. The war is over. The ships left. His ship left from England. And it docked, I think, Newport News or Hampton, you know, wherever the naval base there. And they pulled up to the thing. And before they could set their feet on American soil, walking down the plank, at the end of the plank, you had a sign, colored troops to the left, white troops to the right. And he said he almost broke down and cried right there. So these men, they're right, they should be given their due. These are American heroes, the American patriots, and if this film could be in a small way to illuminate these great Americans, and then we're happy for that.
Well, this is certainly a compliment to all the rest of it. This definitely fills in some of the missing gaps. You know, when little kids my age, you know, used to come home and go, well, where are all the black soldiers in the war? Because we didn't see them in the history books. This is something that they will see. And wish you good luck with it.
Thank you very much.
That was filmmaker and director Spike Lee talking about his new film, Miracle at St. Anna, with NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates. You can watch his full interview plus our conversation with the cast of the film at our website, nprnewsandviews.org.
In 1980, when the actor Robert Wagner turned 50, his wife Natalie Wood threw a surprise party for him. And the guest list tells you the way that Wagner was connected to an earlier age in Hollywood. That guest list included Robert Mitchum, Gene Kelly, Esther Williams, and Henry Fonda. Robert Wagner has written a memoir about his years in that Hollywood, and NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg read it.
When he was 12 in 1942, Robert John Wagner had a crush on the movies. He lived in Bel Air near the golf club. Young R.J. sat under a cluster of trees watching the players. One day, he spotted some golfers leaving the 11th hole.
Those men were Clark Gable, Fred Astaire, Cary Grant, and Jimmy Stewart. I was just transfixed.
In his memoir, Pieces of My Heart, written with Scott Eyman, Robert Wagner says that day he saw his future passing in front of him.
And I just said to myself, oh, boy, would I love to be part of that group. Would I love to be an actor? Would I love to have that feeling that I had, do you know, in seeing them?
Well, he became part of that group a few years later, largely because of another movie icon of the day, Barbara Stanwyck.
I've just been taking a sun bath.
Here with Fred McMurray in Double Indemnity.
Now, about those policies, Mr. Diedrichsen, I hate to take up your time, but...
Oh, that's all right. If you wait till I put something on, I'll be right down.
Stanwyck was a huge star, 4-time Oscar nominee, hardworking, generous. Wagner met her when they were shooting Titanic, the 1953 version, before Leonardo DiCaprio was born. Stanwyck was 45, Wagner was 22. She was his first big love, and in their 4 years together in Hollywood after the war, he became friends with her friends, Clark Gable, Gary Cooper, and, importantly, a father figure he would make two pictures with, Spencer Tracy.
He put his arm around me, and he really felt that I could be somebody. You know, before that, I was, you know, pretty much just a good-looking kid. There were so many of us around.
Tracy thought the kid had talent, a big boost to Wagner's confidence. He also got to know Katharine Hepburn. Wagner's first daughter, Katie, is named for that great star. So, all these marquee pals. Betty Davis, he ended up organizing her memorial service. And he seemed so modest, unegotistical. Sometimes you can almost hear him blush. What was it about you, Robert Wagner? You were gorgeous, you were young, you were winning, you were funny. They liked you.
Yeah. that's a wonderful thing for you to say. I that's one of the reasons that I wrote this book, because I had to acknowledge these people who have been so wonderful to me over my life.
And, but I hear how modest you are, too. Listen to you. You're embarrassed that I gave that string of adjectives, huh?
Well, but it's these people made the difference in my life. They really did.
Actress Natalie Wood made a major difference. They married in 1957 in New York. She was 19, he 27. A car dealer in Chicago offered them a Corvette. The newlyweds began driving home to Los Angeles.
We put the radio on, and it was picked up that we were driving across the United States. And so the radio, the disc jockey or whoever we were listening to that particular time, he said, Natalie Wood and Robert Wagner are driving across the country. They're on I-90 just outside of Lubbock or wherever it was. And suddenly all these kids came out and they were tailing us and trailing us and wishing us good luck. And, oh, it was so terrific. It was great.
But the marriage went flat. They divorced and remarried one another in 1972. Wagner writes movingly of Natalie Wood's death by drowning in 1981. Mysteries and rumors surrounded her death. Wagner believes she slipped off their boat while trying to secure a dinghy in dark, rough seas. All those friends he'd accumulated in Hollywood helped Wagner and his children get through their darkness. Work helped, too, in films and on TV, although that took some arm twisting. In 1968, Lou Wasserman, head of Universal, had a script written for Wagner.
And I said to him, I said, you know, Lou, I really don't want to be a television actor. I'm a movie actor. He said, look, if it doesn't work, I'll make a movie out of it for you, and you're covered both ways. But I think this is your medium.
It was. He starred as Alexander Mundy in the series It Takes a Thief. Mundy, a debonair professional thief, won his freedom by helping the government catch spies. His father, also a thief, was played by Wagner's longtime friend, Fred Astaire.
Well, supposing you successfully steal this $10 million, how much of it will you get?
Nothing. Nothing? Yeah, nothing.
What is this world coming to?
It Takes a Thief was a tremendous hit. So was a later TV series, Heart to Heart, with Wagner and Stephanie Powers as millionaire sleuths out for lots of good times.
Don't you remember? I almost majored in archaeology with a minor in anthropology.
Anthropology? Oh, yeah, that's the study of man. As a member of the species, I have to tell you, you've been neglecting your studies lately.
In the 70s and early 80s, Robert Wagner was a big TV star, but he drew the line at playing cops. He writes, I never wanted to play any character that could conceivably yell, freeze, police.
It's like being on a doctor's show, you know? You don't want to be the doctor. You want to be the patient. Because the patient's always got the better part.
But often the patient is anesthetized.
Yes, but if you're the smart actor, you say, take the needle out of my arm.
Robert J. Wagner. Most recently, in his 60-year career, he's appeared as number two in the Austin Powers films. In his memoir, Pieces of My Heart, Wagner writes this about the joys and responsibilities of his profession. Millions of people arrange their lives so that they can watch actors who mean something to them. Robert Wagner has meant much to many fans. I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
For more about these and other movies, visit our website, npr.org/movies.